Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a majestic swim through the thickening tide of arts and culture in Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we get depth and insight from the artist Sally Payan as she talks through some of the themes, issues, and inspiration behind her current exhibition, The Fence and the Shadow, at MAC Birmingham. We explore the musical glory of the polyphon by way of a pre-performance catch-up with the folk singer, songwriter and composer Luke Daniels, and we get wonderfully lost in the art of making it all up as we dip midway into this week's Birmingham Improv Festival 2017. If you'd like more links and information on any of the features in this programme or the previous shows, you can check out our blog at thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. There's also a podcast archive for those long autumn nights. We start with an intriguing study of women's activism, protest and peace camps through the landscape of Greenham Common. Okay, so I'm really pleased to be here with Sally Payan and Mandy Fowler, who are, I guess, architects, let's use that word, behind women and protest, and in particular, The Fence and the Shadow, which is an exhibition which opened on the 22nd of September, so fairly recently, and runs until the 26th of November here at MAC Birmingham. Now, Sally, I've had a good look around the gallery, and I've had a look at some of the pieces, and I was intrigued by the different exhibitions that we get here at MAC. And to try and help folks get a handle on what your focus is with this, I would say it's probably about the art of protest, and specifically about Greenham Common as a landscape for protest.
It is. It's about the landscape today, walking over Greenham Common today, and thinking about the peace camp from the 1980s, anti-nuclear protest that went on there. I grew up near Greenham. I used to cycle around the base and serve women in a shop. But when it got really big, I went to art school because I was just obsessed to become a painter. So, in a sense, doing this exhibition has been like going back to my roots, back to familiar landscape, and to really kind of look at the mystery of that protest, which was really kind of huge. It's a huge story, actually, what went on there.
And Greenham Common has become, I guess, sort of almost mythical in terms of what's there and what is there and what's been there. And for folks listening who have never ventured outside of the West Midlands, it's somewhere in rural Berkshire, isn't it? Greenham Common.
Yeah.
And it's been used for various things, military things.
Yeah, it's got a long history of aircraft happening there. There were a lot of American Air Force people living there in the 80s. There was kind of almost a village. There were schools, shops, everything, actually, on Greenham Common. Now it's a business park, and the main area is back to being a common land. Greenham Common had the longest runway in Europe in the 80s. If you go there today, there's a central area that they've preserved, and the rest has been dug up and it's under the Newbury bypass. But there's lots of trace elements that relate to the time of when the women were there. If you walk around, there's lots of original fencing. You can tell it's original because it's kind of patched work. There's different fences kind of weaved together, because Greenham women used to always cut through the fence, break them down, or cut through to try and break in to make some kind of protest. So it's,
now, that's an interesting element, I think, of some of the pieces in the exhibition, that idea of patchwork or kind of craft. There's this craft activism phrase, isn't there?
Craftivism,
however you say your A's, you know, it's one or the other.
Yeah, maybe craftivism developed with Greenham Common women. I think that one of the reasons that the women were able to stay there for so long, and with it saying that the... It started in 81 and finally women left in the year 2000 when the land became common land again, was arts and craft. I think it changed their kind of coping mechanism. It's kind of very calming. So in a sense, my approach to this whole exhibition has been about pulling out elements, trace elements that you find on site, and also using archives and interviews. So we have an archive room in there as well, and I interviewed a woman called Lynette Edwell, and that's some of her archive there. And it's the first time this archive's ever been seen. In a sense, I've used the quality of knitting and sewing in the way I've made painting, and the quality of repetition has kind of really come out in the work. So
And what's interesting about that as well, I think, is that there's a very natural element to those crafts and a very tactile nature to some of those things, against perhaps a backdrop that isn't particularly natural in the terms of, you know, how the base is being created and used. There's quite a contrast in those kind of themes, isn't there?
A total con. I mean, how can handicrafts be political? How can it have power? I mean, I found mulling over that over the last year, yeah, amazing, really. But there is a long history of women knitting for war, and there's also knitting and sewing has been kind of a real survival thing for a lot of women. There's a lot of symbols in my work that have come out of looking at knitting and crochet. It's the general approach to the work in general.
And let's talk about the exhibition and bring you in, Mandy, because part of the role of a curator, it's a grand term, isn't it? I like that. It's a great term to have.
Yes.
Part of your role is, it's a really difficult one in terms of ensuring the kind of focus of the exhibition in some ways. And what I mean by that is, Sally, as an artist, is probably prolific in terms of producing things left, right and centre every hour of the day, I guess. And part of your role is sort of filtering that down ensuring that the emphasis is right.
Yeah, so I've worked with Sally through the development of the exhibition. So that's been over a sort of three-year period, really, as the body of work was building up. And I suppose, you know, I always have my eye on that end game in terms of how is this going to look as an exhibition. So I'm always kind of, the conversations that Sally and I have had throughout that time has always been thinking about that wider picture, and particularly audiences responding to it and how we're going to present it to audiences as well. So one of the things that was quite key is to, whilst, you know, we know a lot about Greenham Common, we're especially aware that, you know, people of maybe particularly a certain age might not understand any of the context of Greenham at all or understand that. So it was kind of how did we deal with that, whilst Sally is an artist's response to the subject, and Sally's pulled through the areas that she's been interested in terms of creating the work. But it's kind of how do we do that without presenting a history show as well? So within the archive space particularly, we looked at how to do that. And, you know, quite often exhibitions have resource rooms as well attached to them that gives you some further information about the artist and their thinking behind that. But what we really wanted to do as well was combine that with the context of Greenham. So it was really important, Sally accessing the archive that she talked about and using that as sort of inspiration and presenting some of that to the members of the public. So we were incredibly lucky, so that, as Sally mentioned, the archive isn't publicly available yet, but we were given special permission to actually have some of the archive material here at MAC. And that's been particularly selected on the basis of what Sally's responded to, again, as opposed to showing a kind of history. There is a timeline of the and the background information to give people that kind of context, but that those archives have come from the women directly themselves, and so it really is their personal items connected to Greenham. So that was quite important to us as well, and that sort of sits alongside the exhibition.
Hmm.
So Sally's work sort of, you know, stands up as a body of work, but that's some of the background information and that kind of context, so that people can view the work through that lens as well, and kind of understanding where Sally's come from in those stories of Greenham.
And that's a really interesting challenge, and I think it is about that sort of capturing that kind of narrative, that historical narrative, but ensuring that there's relevance. You know? And it's clear to me from the minute you walk into the exhibition, these are pertinent, relevant themes. You know, we're talking about nuclear disarmament,
exactly.
And we're talking about neoconservative military agenda,
those kind of women's things. Protest, women's activism. It is very much that kind of, you know, contemporary context to that as well. And, you know, while Sally's work is talking about, you know, a particular point in time, it's also timeless as well. And that was something that we really wanted to try and bring out as well. So, and again, giving people that sense of the landscape of Greenham now as well. It's kind of, how do we do that? We talked about that, and then Sally filming her walk around Greenham so that visitors to the exhibition have got that sort of sense of what Greenham is like now as well. And it was we dealt with it in that way of, it was actually Sally's journey across the landscape rather than just putting up a map of Greenham and you know, some photographs of the space to give people that kind of sense.
So there is, just to describe parts of the exhibition, and most of the works I think are sort of oil on canvas.
Yeah.
That's the kind of your medium, if you.
I love making oil paintings. Yeah, there's lots of, there's 9 large scale oil paintings and an area where there's loads of different small ones. So they're kind of very different touch and scale going across the whole thing.
Mm.
Some of my original decisions were that the works would be from the ground up because the Greenham women organise themselves without a hierarchy, you know. So although we know that Greenham, the women were doing an anti-nuclear protest, they were also very much about women's issues and had endless conversations about how they would be organised. So being an leaderless protest movement was really crucial. So in a sense, my work has kind of a more earthy, primitive feel to it, which is quite conscious. Half of the large scale works are about the women's relationship with the fence. For instance, after Embrace the Base, which was an action when 30,000 women encircled the 9-mile perimeter of the fence, linking arms.
That's an incredible number of people.
It's an incredible thing. But after that, they're invited to tie things to the fence that were important to them. So there'd be kind of photographs of their children, children's clothing, knitting, things they made, symbols, anything from the heart, really. Children, photographs. So those 3 paintings are very inspired by that when I've got kind of symbols tied to the fence. The other work is much more influenced by walking over Greenham today, looking for the trace elements of that time. So we've got the silos. The silos are still there. They're now considered to be an ancient monument. But in the time of Greenham Common, there would have, the protest, 96 nuclear weapons were living in there. So it's really scary.
There's also quite a clever element, I think, to the exhibition where you've got a video screen, a TV screen, with the kind of real-time, almost real-time kind of, you know, walk around as you describe it.
Yeah.
Now, I think that very cleverly gives you a kind of window on something that's very real.
Yeah.
When you're faced with, I suppose, some of the images instantly, you might think, oh, is that real? What is that? You know, and it helps link that and helps ground that.
Well, when I decided to do the walk, I was actually at Greenham and I just thought, I need to film this. It kind of grew quite intuitively. And then I felt that the walk kind of evolved as I was, in this very similar way to how I would make the painting. Mm. So there's kind of a lot of action-based mark making in my painting. It's very much about repetition, so it's very much like knitting and endurance and just keeping going.
I think there's also a tradition of artists walking as well, and you know, the kind of the artist's view as they're walking, what is it they're taking in, what is it they're, you know, interested in. And I think again that was, you know, the kind of careful positioning of the camera within that as well, is that, you know, it's attached to Sally. It is very much her viewpoint of walking through that site now.
Now, there's also, I want to ask you this just to finish, there's also an important woman who features in this exhibition, which is Margaret Thatcher, I think.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of, I would say, they're not really portraits, I guess they're profiles in some ways, and they capture very well the Margaret Thatcher quiff, I think.
Yeah,
that kind of very glamorised modern politician, if you like.
Well, that kind of grew out of... The 80s aren't complete without Margaret Thatcher. But it was... I did a protest, one of the protesters and their relationship with the fence and their hair becoming the fence. And I just kind of realised I had to do Margaret Thatcher's hair because her hair was so particular.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the lines in the fence and the lines in hair and the lines through knitting, the lines in landscape, weather maps, aircraft coming and going. This kind of was all meshing in my mind, as you know. But her little potent eyes staring down at
I think that's really interesting, actually, in the way in which Sally approached that. It's not a full portrait of Margaret Thatcher. It is just, you know, within a few painterly lines that it's very obvious, you know, who it is. And that's, you know, that's, I think that's amazing as an artist to be able to do that within just a couple of lines.
I have got a bit of text on one painting, which is the title of the painting, but it's also written into it, and it's Every Woman and the Angel of Death, which I kind of was very inspired through some reading that I was doing. But I just feel all the Greenham women were known as Every Woman, But Margaret Thatcher isn't that. So in a sense, that's why she's the only one you could recognise there, because she's not an every woman. She's not anonymous, you know, and it relates to the Greenham women not having a hierarchy.
Excellent. So there's lots of things going on at the MAC, and the exhibition The Fence and the Shadow runs till Sunday, 26th of November. So folks have got plenty of time to come and see it and view it, enjoy it several times. And I'm certainly coming back at least two or three times, because I think it's fascinating. What other things are you working on? What's next? What other things are you sort of brewing up?
At the moment, I'm actually trying to finish some work that's looking at biomimicry in nature. That's my current thing. But I'm actually still using ideas about Greenham in that, because a lot of the symbols that the Greenham women developed were from nature. So it's process-led biomimicry. So that's kind of one thing I'm working on. And I'm still totally addicted to doing work about ex-Cold War sites and the nuclear issue. And even the set of paintings in there, I've got three paintings about The Fence. That could easily be eight. It's a huge body of work I'm carrying on with, basically. So I imagine I'll be here for the next few years.
Excellent. That's great to hear. And in the meantime, Sally and Mandy, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more on Sally's work at www.sallypayen.info. That's P-A-Y-E-N. The exhibition The Fence and the Shadow runs until Sunday the 26th of November at MAC Birmingham's First Floor Gallery. For more information, go to macbirmingham.co.uk or call 0121 446 3232. Now, ever wondered at the CD player as its gentle whizzing breaks into crisp sound? No? Just me then. Anyhow, for a more complicated mechanism, I caught up with Luke Daniels prior to his recent gig at the MAC to help get a grip on the machinery of metal disc folk.
I'm pleased to be with Luke Daniels here at the MAC.
Hello, James. And, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, and we've been already having a fascinating conversation over a burger.
That's right, a quarter-eaten burger.
But we thought what we'd better do is commit some of the conversation to tape.
Okay.
Because that's quite a good idea.
Good idea, yes.
So let's start, Luke. Well, we'll start with you, because you're an interesting character, because you're a mix of things, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You're a singer-songwriter.
Yes.
But you're a composer.
Yes.
And you're also, interested to learn, you do a couple of other things. You're a folk musician in residence.
Yes.
And a tutor as well. So tell me a little bit about these wonderful badges you wear.
Well, I'm sort of 20 years into my career as a professional musician, and I come from a background of traditional and folk music, because that's what my parents played. The first band I ever played in was a Cayley band. And so I've got a huge interest and a huge love of traditional music. I've always played, something I still do for fun. Well, I'm based up in Glasgow. I'll happily go out of an evening and just play a few tunes in one of the local pubs with some friends if I've got the time. So all of my work has this thread of folk and traditional music running through it, whether that's my performing, as I'm here to do tonight, whether that's my compositions, like the commissioned work I did for the Performing Rights Society Foundation back in 2014, which looked at cattle droving and some of the traditional music from Wales and Scotland that was involved in that, or whether it's my teaching. And I run a charity which delivers these folk academies up and down, let's say, I think the most southerly one we have is Barrow in Furness, and then the most northerly one we have is Aberdeen. And we teach kids to play traditional music and research tunes from their own part of the world. So yeah, I do lots of things, but it's definitely true to say that the glue to my output, if you like, is folk and traditional music.
And now let's talk about the machine, as we were. Like Florence, you have a machine.
Yes.
You see what I did there?
Yes.
Now this is a polyphon. Is that what it's called?
It's called a polyphon. I was led to it after a project I did with the Glasgow Royal Conservatoire of Music, where I'm a tutor, so I have access to these wonderful archives. They have a lot of wax cylinder and 78 recordings of traditional Scottish musicians, and this one guy in particular called William Hannah, who was a really good melodeon player. One of my main instruments is the squeeze box. We transcribed and re-recorded a lot of these wax cylinders and 78s, And I began thinking, after that project was finished, what existed prior to sort of wax cylinders or the gramophone? What was there? And went back to the company that manufactured, one of the main manufacturers of gramophones was a company called Deutsche Grammophon, which still exists today as a classical music label. I don't know if you're familiar with Deutsche Grammophon, the lovely recordings, very sort of top end classical stuff.
I've read a little about them. Are they? They're based in Leipzig or somewhere.
Yes, that's right. Exactly right. Well, they started out with a factory in Leipzig, and they were called Deutsche Polyphon. In fact, that machine, they made that machine from an early incarnation of Deutsche Grammophon. They produced polyphons for about 20, 30 years, between about 1880 and 1910, until it just became blindingly obvious that these machines were way too complicated when they didn't, they could just make gramophones, you know.
And this machine, in terms of your performance, in terms of your work,
mm-hmm.
it's something that you've, I guess, you know, more and more used as an instrument, mm-hmm. and sort of have tinkered with, let's put it that way, in a technical term.
When I work in bands, you know, I do kind of collaborative projects, but my touring show is a solo show. You know, I like the flexibility, and I don't like having to check with other musicians every time I get offered a gig as to whether I can do it or not. However, I do have a kind of a partner in crime, and this is the Polyphon machine, because not only does it play music on its 20-inch steel discs that I can play along with, I can also stop and start these discs and record them and then sync the discs to these recordings. So it's a bit like having a loop pedal where I'm looping sections played by the machine. And the machine itself obviously runs from these discs, these Polyphon discs, which I also program and make myself. So if I've written a piece of music, I put it onto the disc in the form of little P-shaped hooks which sit around circular tracks on the back of the disc. And these hooks, as they pass the 6 o'clock point on the machine's bed plate, circular bed plate, they ping these teeth, a bit like a music, well, exactly like a music box, not a bit like a music box. It's a large 7-octave music box.
It sounds like a labour of love doing something like that. It sounds like you're up to the small hours, perhaps.
It's reduced me to tears 3 times, this machine, and I've given up on the project twice. I've never known a project. I mean, even a week ago, we had a catastrophe with it where the thing just dramatically stopped working before one of the gigs. It's par for the course when you're working with bespoke electronics and technology. You know, I mean, the machine, the bed plate is from 1880. The rest of it's 2017. I only said 18 then. It's from the future.
And it's already apparently developing some of the sensibilities of other band members and colleagues, perhaps. What, maybe that's why it's getting temperamental.
Yeah,
you know, perhaps
it may be. No, I think we find our way with these things. There's no map to try and do something like this. No one has. I mean, this is the first new music that's been written for the machine in over 130 years. First Polyphon pieces in that length of time. No one has ever synced a clockwork mechanism to digital music. And so, you know, you're gonna have to sort of make mistakes and fix them as you go. But I've never known a project where I work with someone. I should say this, actually. I should credit where credit's due. My teammate in all this is a guy called Sebastian Lexer, who's a German electronic engineer, also based in Glasgow, who teaches at the university up there. And without him, I wouldn't have got this far. I mean, I had the idea for the project, but he has produced all the electronics to make it possible. And, you know, Sebastian and me, we get together, and I can think of at least 10 occasions where we've just had to stop. It's like, we're totally screwed. There's no way we're going to solve this problem. And then, lo and behold, sort of 3 hours later, we found a way around and we're up and running again, only to find that there's another massive problem that would seem to make the whole thing not possible. However, we've got through all that, and we are at a point now where it works. Thank you.
I think what's fascinating about your music and the work that you do is that you manage, I think, quite successfully to merge quite traditional sort of constraints, but with technology and new things.
Mm.
And you made an album, I think, at the beginning of this year called Making Waves.
That's the instrumental one I mentioned
so
a moment ago.
You were kind of...
There's a little bit of polyphon on that, although it's mainly polyphon samples.
And you're grabbing things from all across the internet, essentially.
Yeah, it started... from a practical point of view, it started because I had an album to make for the company that I work for, based over in Dublin. I normally have to do one for them, you know, once every sort of 16 months. And it was the summer holidays. I had sort of festival gigs at the weekend, but during the week, my wife runs a hairdressing salon. So she wasn't really around to look after the children. I've got two girls. Someone had to be there. I need to be at home. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll instead of making a record by going away to a studio for 3 weeks, I'll make a record at home by gathering as much open source audio samples as I can from the internet. Loads of old BBC recordings, RTE recordings, and a Lomax stuff that was recorded in the States. And I'll stitch it all together and make some pieces out of it. And then write tunes that can go over the top. And then finally, I got three other really great players to come in and record their parts over the top of these tracks that I'd created. And I'd say it's not an album for the faint-hearted. It was reviewed by the Australian national newspaper, one of the main newspapers in Australia last month, and described as discombobulated. Although the guy did like it, it's... I had an opportunity to make a record that I didn't really need to make it fit anything. It was just let's just go as far as we can with this and not sort of bear any consideration to whether it's fitting with any kind of set genre. Certainly it divided the folk world as to whether it was a good record or not. There's some absolutely crazy stuff on that record. The best way to make a record is to get really six or seven really good players in a room for 3 weeks and just play music together and record it. You know, that's massively expensive these days. And for certain types of record, like the one I've just done, that's exactly what I did because it was the kind of record I wanted to make.
And let me talk to you about that, because that one's coming out on the 24th of November, yeah. I think, so yeah. Folks can make a note of that. And it's called Singing Ways to Feel More Junior.
Yes.
So tell me about that, because there's a kind of... There's a sort of a children's story element, I think, to it. Is that right?
I've used a lot of references to children's nursery rhymes and a lot of female allegory as well. I was thinking a lot about the kind of gender inequality and the way that children, young people, particularly their views, they never really get a high level of representation within the arts. They're often... the subject of a lot of arts funding rather than the idea that they could actually have a voice within music. So this kind of, I guess this drove a lot of the ideas behind the songs. At the end of the day, there is an element of children's music, and as I said, kind of the idea, I mean, there's a song about Donald Trump on it, there's a song about addiction on it, but it's a collection of songs. It's an album in the kind of the more traditional sense. You know, I went away and I wrote 10 songs that I was happy with, and then I recorded them in a studio with four musicians that I really like playing with. And there's no kind of caveat thrown in there, as the Polyphon machine was completely with the second record. The idea was to have a machine that was so strange to people that it would grab the attention of a lot of the reviewers. With this Singing Ways to Feel More Junior, I've consciously tried to make a much more straightforward recording of songs that I hope people would agree are good songs, you know. I think with repertoire like that, there's no point dressing up too much.
We live in the house the Jack built. We broke the bill, the jail spill. Now we are ran away, so all aboard the hackered people. We live in the house the Jack built. We broke the bill, the jail spill. Now we my love, ain't nothing gonna change. Crown each male man, my love, from the cradle to his grave. A woman's work is never done.
my love that's run out all the way. Though some of us competing only turn out for the day. Cleopatra, Empress Wu, and Elizabeth the First. Exceptions to the rule, my love, ain't that the truth I'm
Let me ask you, if I can, about Middle-earth, okay? Because you have some Tolkien connections.
Yes.
You do, don't you? Mm-hmm. And where we're sitting now is pretty much, I think, on the edge of Hobbiton.
Mm.
Okay, so Tolkien, when he sort of crafted the initial drafts of The Hobbit and things, was thinking about bits of Birmingham, or was thinking about, you know, Sourell Mill and, you know, some of the sort of, I guess, some of the wasteland, if you like, of some of the industrial...
industrialization.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask you about that because you've sort of done some of the orchestral sort of soundtrack bits.
I had a relationship with the London Philharmonic, which, and Howard Shaw, who's the composer of all the music for Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I used to fix is the word, or kind of manage. I pulled in a team of musicians for the orchestra to do these live performances, and we were called the Hobbit Band, affectionately, by the rest of the orchestra. And it was a harpist, a hammered dulcimer player, a fiddle player, a box player, and then there was a penny whistle player as well, although he was actually from the orchestra. He was one of the flute players in the orchestra, would do that part. So yeah, we did about 9 concerts altogether at the Royal Festival Hall, the Royal Albert Hall. It was a really great experience. And then when it came to doing the Hobbit films, there was obviously more folk music involved in those, so then we went back and did those as well. It was great fun. It was about 5-6 years ago, I think. Since then there's been sort of other forays into movies as a result. There was a film that came out called Whiskey Galore recently, and I was one of the musicians involved in that as well. So yeah, as a jobbing musician, you get these opportunities come along and you grab them with both hands. And it's a job of work, really, and fun as well if you're lucky.
And you are very busy at the moment, because I want to mention some of the places on the map that you're dashing across to. So you're doing some gigs in Galloway and Glasgow, which is sort kind of, I guess, your neck of the woods,
that's
really
stomping ground, yeah, really. Yeah.
And then nice and easy, you're going to Falmouth from Glasgow. That's a good trek.
Yes.
And Penzance, you're taking in, and Stroud, and you're doing the Ilfracombe Festival.
Yes.
You're doing Torrington, and then towards the end of the year, you're doing Sheffield and Belfast as well.
So. Yeah, they were two gigs that have been moved back. Right? From the beginning of December, I start a Christmas tour as part of Cara Dillon's band, and there were a couple of days off on that. So I looked at that and thought, oh, I've got a day off in Sheffield, let's just do a Sheffield gig. And I got in touch with a friend of mine called Nancy Kerr, who's a singer and a fantastic musician, and we're going to do a double header. And then a day off over in Northern Ireland as well on this Christmas tour with Cara. There's a day when I'm going to do a gig in Belfast, an impromptu gig in Belfast. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to this evening's gig.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to hearing the polyphon and hope you don't fall out with it. Let's put it that way. I'm sure you won't.
But it does what it's supposed to. We're okay.
But for now, Luke, thanks very much for talking to me. Thanks for your time.
All right, you're welcome.
Go to lukedanielsmusic.com for a biog, tour dates and a gallery. All well worth further investigation. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. Regular listeners of the show will appreciate what a highly polished, well-crafted piece of radio it is. Nothing you may gather is made up on the spot. But what if it had to be? I got nervous, intrigued and involved with Birmingham Improv Festival director John Trevor at a recent gathering in Moseley. Here's how I got on.
Okay, so against type, I have prepared for this interview and I'm very pleased to be with John Trevor, who's the festival director for Birmingham Improv Festival.
Well said.
Now, John, tell me about that, because I've no idea what that is.
It's a one-week festival of improvisation, mostly comedy, a lot of musicals. It's theatre and comedy made up on the spot by the people in front of you.
So there must be some rules. Are there any rules?
Laugh when it's funny.
That would help, wouldn't it, I guess.
Well, each group is doing specific things. So, for example, we've got a company coming called Impromptu Shakespeare. They make up a fresh Shakespeare play every time with iambic pentameters and all the plot and all the cross-dressing and everything else. But it's a new one every time.
And there's a bit of Dickens as well, I think.
There's a company that's doing a Dickens show. They call it What the Dickens. That's Foghorn. They're a Birmingham-based company. And they make up a new Dickens story based on an audience suggestion.
And before we dig into the programme, because you've got a really interesting programme of events and activities coming up towards the end of October, I want to ask you about yourself and how you kind of delved into this realm of improvisation. I would suggest, some people would say, it's really easy to make things up, but it's not. It really isn't.
Well, it is.
Is it?
Yes, anyone can make anything up. Making up something coherent in front of an audience is harder. Anyone can make anything up. I mean, you and I, let's do a bit of improv right now,
let's
you and me.
Okay?
We're going to tell a story,
okay,
but we're going to add one word at a time each.
Okay, we'll try and get the listeners to stay on that dial. Yes, go on.
Okay, so once
upon
a
time
there
was
a
Welshman
called
Gwener.
Now, Gwener
lived
in
a cave on
Mount
Sinai
and so on. So very easily we can make up stuff, and improv, as you've seen, is a collaborative art form. It involves not just one person thinking up stuff, but people working together.
I think I nearly got carried away there. maybe I'll get subsumed into it, I don't know. But you're an interesting character yourself, because you've done lots of acting things. You've kind of 20 years in acting or something?
Well, no, I was a director. I was an actor very briefly for about 2 years till I discovered how bad I was.
Okay.
And then I, in the greater spirit of if those that can't tell other people how to do it, I became a director for about 20 years.
Is that how people become directors?
Yeah, and those that can't do that teach directing. It, you know, it moves up the scale.
And you lecture as well, I think, in sort of theatre, is that right?
I taught drama, I was a theatre director, I had a career for about, as I say, about 20 years, but eventually I stopped and I do other things now, but I still had the itch somewhere down the line, and about 8 years ago I started teaching and performing improv here in Birmingham because there was very little going on.
You had that kind of nagging doubt, as it were, you know, that kind of, oh, I must do something, or maybe I shouldn't.
Just wanted to be a bit creative. I wanted to do something that was a bit fun and a bit creative. I looked around for an improv group, couldn't find one, so I started this drop-in that we're here at today called Box of Frogs, and it's been running for 9 years ever since.
And there's a very cunning line, isn't there, related to Box of Frogs?
Is
as mad as.
As mad as, exactly.
Mad as, that's where it comes from, just in case people wondered. So,
yeah.
Let's go back to the Birmingham Improv Festival. It's running from the 23rd to the 29th of October.
Yes.
I think I've got my dates right. It's at the Blue Orange Theatre.
Yes.
In the Jewellery Quarter.
Great Hampton Street.
Which I don't know myself, so tell us a little bit about that venue.
It's a lovely, lovely space. It's been around for, I don't know, I'll get into trouble if I get the time wrong. I'd say probably 6-7 years, something like that. It's a 100-seater, beautiful little studio theatre, very well equipped, very comfortable. It's not a room above a pub, it is a purpose-built theatre. It's lovely.
People are assured when you say things like that. It's not a pub. I think that's a good thing.
You can buy a drink there. It has got a bar, but it's not a grotty, smelly room above a pub.
And you've got, I think, 24 companies involved in the programme for the festival this year.
Correct.
Which is around about 21, 22 shows?
Yes, so some of the shows are double bills, two companies sharing an hour. But yes, it's 21 shows spread over the week. Just a bit of background. Last year was our first ever festival. So having run for 8 years as a drop-in, there's been all sorts of offshoots coming out of Box of Frogs. Companies have formed. There's a good half dozen Birmingham-based groups now doing their own thing. And last year I went, we should have a festival. So we did. And it was one weekend at the Blue Orange that we had 10 companies come and do shows. And so we went, this year we're going to be bigger, better, brummier.
Yes, I saw that phrase, brummier.
Because last year all the shows that came in were invited from outside. I wanted to show off some of the best improv in the country to Birmingham. This year we've got a mix of invited acts from outside and Birmingham-based and wider Midland-based organisations.
So how, since last year's the kind of the first festival, how's the scene grown? How's
just improvisation grown, as
it
were.
Just keeps growing and growing. I mean, I'm in three groups that are all Birmingham based. I work with companies, I guest with a company in Leicester sometimes and one in Coventry. I would say Birmingham has now got, I've lost track, 8 or 9 performing groups that come and go, or are doing different things. A new one's just started. As of about 6 weeks ago, a group called Off Broad Street.
I like what they did there.
Exactly, which I'm in, who do improvised musicals, and we're actually having our first gig ever tomorrow night, but by the time this goes out, it would have been a month ago, so you're going to miss it.
The joy of radio. Now, there's another fantastic thing that you do, which I noticed in the programme, which is you have a gala fundraiser evening, which I think is to kind of close the festival. Is that the idea?
Not quite. It's on the last day. It's on the Sunday. It's from 2 o'clock till 4 o'clock. It's a format, it's called Maestro, which will mean nothing to you, but basically it's about 14 improvisers take to the stage and do a series of scenes, and the audience gets to vote, and gradually they get eliminated until the King of Maestro or Queen is left at the end, which is sort of our improviser of the year, who wins the prize, which I haven't invented what it's going to be yet.
That sounds very dangerous, putting things to a popular vote with people with limited understanding.
But it's an entertaining art form, so if people don't like it, they won't vote for it. It's got to be, if audiences don't like it, there's no point in doing it.
Well, that's a good recommendation, I think. Now, tell me a little bit about the workshops that go on, because as you alluded to earlier, we are kind of in a workshop space, not in a cave. It might sound that we're probably hiding under a sink or something, but tell me about how the workshops kind of have grown and how they work, because I'm going to be hanging around a bit later on, I think, much to the dismay of these folks looking over our shoulder.
So every Tuesday night here in Moseley, people gather. It's not a fixed number of people. People come, people go. I'd say probably over the last 9 years, 400 or 500 people have come or gone through it. We're here for 2 hours. We start the evening. Hopefully you're going to stay and play with us and you'll find out. We play some games, we warm up, we do some group exercises, and then we do some performance stuff. We build skills, we make up stuff. I try and impart new ways of doing improv or new aspects of it, because there's always new things to learn, and we have fun and we laugh a lot.
Oh my God.
Oh, you're in trouble.
Oh my God.
You're in terrible trouble. I'm glad I wasn't anywhere near it when that happened.
I was just cleaning it and it just fell.
Yes, I saw.
I thought they're supposed to be like attached to the pot, but it just...
No. No, they're loose. It's part of the new free and open and airy-fairy and look where it's got us.
I'm so now.
You are.
Well, this technically...
It's completely your fault, nothing to do with me.
But we're both on shift.
I'm going to report you now.
You were here. You were even...
I was over here.
Technically, it's your kind of fault as well.
So, John, there's some exciting workshops, I think, happening as part of the festival.
There are. There's a special kids workshop on the Wednesday, the 25th, I believe that'll be, in the morning. And then in the afternoon, there's a kids show. Boxer Fogs will be doing a kids show Wednesday afternoon. And then there's another kids show on the Saturday. Showstopper, who I talked about already, are doing their amazing kids Showstopper show. So it's also a musical made up, but they only take suggestions from the kids, not from the adults.
Excellent.
And whatever the kids say, they make happen.
That is very dangerous, isn't it?
but they make it work. There are other workshops for adults, so impromptu Shakespeare are doing a how to do improvised Shakespeare workshop. The May Days are doing a workshop on how to play objects on stage, how to be an improvising light bulb or sofa. And we've got MC Hammersmith, who's late night Saturday. He's doing a Sunday morning workshop, improvised rap.
That sounds excellent already. I thought you were going to say MC Hammer, and then you went another route, didn't you?
Yeah, that's his joke name. He calls himself MC Hammersmith, and he's an amazing improvising rapper. So you give him a topic, and he just does a whole funny thing on it.
So if there are folks out there listening who are perhaps sitting there thinking, oh, I'm not sure about a workshop, oh, I don't know about that, that John guy sounds quite confident, what would you say to them? What would you say to entice them?
I'd say come and have fun. You will have fun. There will be other beginners there. You won't feel stupid. You won't be humiliated. And it's a tenner. I mean, come on, it's hardly a risk.
So presumably a lot of the folks that are kind of drawn to these kind of sessions have a kind of, I suppose, an acting interest or a theatrical interest, but is there something about sort of confidence and meeting folks? And
people come for all sorts of reasons. So some are actors wanting to improve their skills, not that high a proportion. Some just want to have fun. Some writers come because it's actually a good doorway into writing and understanding how to structure a scene. But we have accountants and doctors, and we have, funnily enough, two actuaries. It's hard enough to find one, but we have two who come along to Box of Frogs. So people from really across the board. We have more or less everything. People come for all sorts of reasons.
Okay, so folks that want to come along to Birmingham Improv Festival, where should they look to find out all the fun and games?
www.birminghamimprovfestival.com.
Excellent. And now there's a full array of things. Are there particular things you're looking forward to yourself?
So it's a return visit from Showstopper. Showstopper are amazing. We don't get the full company because we can't fit them on the stage, but they make up a full West End musical every time. They came last year, they sold out, they always sell out wherever they go. They raised the roof. They did an amazing made-up musical called Two Nights in the Bull Ring, which I can still remember the songs from. They're coming back. They are going to be fabulous. They're always fabulous. They're selling out. So I don't know if by the time this goes out, people will still be able to buy tickets, but if they can, grab one. I'm really looking forward to the Maydays, who are coming on the Friday night of the festival. They do a thing called Happily Never After. It's they do a dark, twisted musical in the style of Tim Burton and the Grimm Brothers. So it'll be funny, but dark and somber.
So in some ways, folks don't quite know what to expect, do they, from this?
No two shows are alike. They all have a company will put together a show with a particular feel or a particular theme, but it's always going to be different every time. It's always going to be good. I've curated this carefully to make sure we have all the best acts.
Excellent. So I shall be, as you said, I shall be tagging along later on, see what occurs at the workshop. But for now, John, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
You'll be Alice, so you'll do Old Job You, John. Okay. First of all, a relationship between these two people, a bit so a customer, a client service relationship.
Oh, new jobish.
Yeah, well. But it's some kind of service.
Hot surgeon.
Yeah. Surgeon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Talking. Yeah.
So, surgeon operating under local anaesthetic?
Oh. Could be, yeah.
Yep. Surgeon operating under local anaesthetic. Old job?
Interior decorator.
Interior
decorator.
Yeah! Sure! you're the patient, yes. This is your surgeon who's actually operating on you under local anaesthetic. I don't know. Arrange your patient as you need them, I think.
You can sit there. It's a new technique. good afternoon, Mr. Ford. Are you comfortable?
I'm okay, I'm a bit nervous.
Mm-hmm. Are you feeling sort of, how's your well-being?
Yeah, I'm feeling a bit drowsy.
If I ask you...
Okay, I'm going to ask you to cut to the surgery.
Okay.
We're now doing the surgery.
If you just stay still, what we do is, it's similar to our technique.
To the surgery, you're now doing it. There we go.
Oh dear. Not enough talk on that one, I'm afraid. Have you thought about off-white?
It's kind of a strange sensation, to be honest.
Bone fragments are usually a little darker.
It's reassuring.
Have you thought about a hat at all? Sort of to set off the centrepiece? there will be quite an indentation, I'm afraid.
Okay, right. Well, if that's an option.
Oh, dear. Oh yes, I found the brain, that's the good news.
Right.
It's very small.
Right.
But what we can do is you can work wonders with mirrors, you know. kind of techno feeling.
Really?
Yes. All you've really got to do is just see past the kind of minimal space that you've got.
Okay.
Can you still see?
I can
that's reassuring. Yeah. That's reassuring. I'm just going to drill a hole in the other side,
okay.
Just because I've noticed.
Is that absolutely necessary?
I've noticed it's a supporting piece of the skull. So I'm a little bit unsure about that.
Yeah.
But don't worry, a bit of solder, it'll be fine. And a little tip for you. A dry brushing technique.
Right.
For the hair.
Right.
So if the hair won't grow back, or indeed the head comes off, you can dry brush cover it. Lovely. Doily, perhaps?
Be Quick, as the Birmingham Improv Festival only runs until Sunday, the 29th of October. Tickets, information, and a full lineup are available at birminghamimprovfestival.com. And you can catch all the action on Twitter at Beeham Improv Fest. And now it's time to close the box. Tune in to our next show on the 22nd of November for a chat with the writer, comic and poet John Hegley, some inspiring tunes from Dan Whitehouse and Jess Morgan, as well as a spot of community theatre. My thanks to Sally Payan and Mandy Fowler, Mac Birmingham, Luke Daniels, John Trevor and the improv players at Box of Frogs, and Mandy Rose at M7PR. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio.